Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Nellie Bailey is doing the people's work elsewhere this week. Coming up, a famed whistleblower says the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is racked with racism, and Ralph Nader has a plan to mount a challenge to President Obama in the primaries. But first, the once great black metropolis of Detroit is steadily shrinking. In the last decade, the Motor City lost one quarter of its population and is now hovering at a little over 700,000 people. Shanta Driver of BAM, By Any Means Necessary, says Detroit is getting smaller because the public school system is being deliberately downsized.
In the last 5 years, there's been more than half of all of the Detroit public schools closed down, and that means that there are whole neighborhoods now in which there's neither an elementary school nor a middle school. And then on top of that, there's been schools that have been consolidated into single buildings. Many of the high schools and elementary schools and middle schools consolidated into a single building, which has meant that there's been a dramatic spike in violence in those schools, on top of the school closings. And really that just creates the conditions where for anyone who can get out of Detroit and get to some other place, some place where they can know that their child is in a safe school, relatively close to home, and has access to a decent education, then if you can afford to get out, you do. And you can just see it in Detroit. It's almost like when you drive through certain neighborhoods of Detroit, it's like watching, locusts eat through a field. You can see neighborhoods that are being abandoned by those that can leave, and houses just destroyed, just pillaged. And then on the same block, there might be one or two houses standing besides three or four that have just been destroyed. And street after street after street after street like that. And then you'll come to a big road, and there'll still be some of the elementary schools and middle schools standing. There'll be access to a real neighborhood comprehensive high school, and the neighborhood will be almost completely intact. And what we're so fearful of now is that this summer we're looking at half of the remaining schools in Detroit being up for closure or being sold off to charter schools. And if that happens, then we know that those neighborhoods that have survived, that are still stable, are going to be, placed in the position that, again, that people will have to make a choice whether or not they can really afford, from the standpoint of their child's safety and well-being and education, whether to stay or whether to try to get out. It's really a crime.
So let's be clear. You're saying that school closings are responsible for depopulating Detroit, not the other way around.
That's exactly right. If you look at the total number of students in the city of Detroit, if you look at it over the last few years, that number of students had only really started to shrink once they were the big school closings. There was a period of time, maybe about 5 years ago, in which there was some exodus of students to charter schools, but there was exactly the same number of students in total of Detroit students, either at a charter school or public school, as there had been 10 or 12 years ago. And now what we're seeing is not only are some of the students being forced into suburban charter schools, because there's still only a tiny number of charter schools in the city of Detroit, but we're seeing whole families that have moved out as a result of the school closings, as that's intensified over the last few years.
And you also maintain this is by design.
It is by design. I think there's been a proposal out there. There was started with Governor Granholm, who was the Democratic Party governor of our state. Now it's being extended by the Republican governor of our state, Governor Snyder, to turn Detroit into what they're calling a cool city. A cool city, according to them, would be a city of about 500,000 people, which is what Detroit is shrinking into. And there's been continuous threats by the mayor of policies of turning off the gas and the electricity for whole areas of the city. The mayor, who doesn't even live in the city of Detroit and obviously is not defending us at all, just comes out right out and says Detroit is just too large a land area to support the population that's in Detroit now, and that we need to literally just shutter neighborhoods and close whole neighborhoods down in addition to the school closings. And that's really kind of a remarkable situation to be in, to see your city just being consciously destroyed. And I will say this about Detroit. I think this would not be happening to us if anyone thought that Detroit was a place where a white person could be elected mayor of the city, which no one believes that that's going to happen right now in Detroit. It's our determination to hold on to the vestiges of black power that were won in the 1960s and 1970s in the city of Detroit that I think has just forced or has created this concerted attack against our city.
Do people suspect that the plan is to clear vast areas of Detroit of anybody, of black people certainly, and then begin a kind of development once those areas are empty that would pull in a different population down the road?
Absolutely. I mean, I think everyone thinks that the downtown area is being built up and that there's a real effort to bring white people back into downtown Detroit. They've been special programs set up to bring police that have moved into far suburbs, most of whom are white police, back into the city with guarantees of down payments on new dwellings and very, very low prices for those houses or condominiums and guaranteed interest rates. There's a number of the downtown corporations practically give away apartments and condominiums to employees that are prepared to live in downtown Detroit. There's kind of a standing joke in Detroit that if you drive downtown almost any time of the day, you see white people jogging around the downtown streets of Detroit. Most of us believe that they're paid joggers because you don't see anybody else jogging all throughout downtown Detroit, you know, kind of from 6 in the morning until it's dark outside, except for these handful of people that seem to be running all the time. And I think it is just to create the image that downtown Detroit is a safe and desirable place for white people to live.
So it has been decreed that the black metropolis will cease to exist.
I think that's right. I think that is the decree. I think we're looking at a situation in which there's a concerted effort to turn Detroit back into the Detroit of the pre-1967 rebellion Detroit, a city that's very segregated, a city in which the finest housing and the downtown area is reserved for white people, and in which the black population and now the Latino population are contained in specifically ghettoized areas that are limited in terms of their geography and limited in terms of the education and the rights and the aspirations and the hopes and the quality of life that you can attain in them.
What has been the impact in Detroit schools specifically, of Michigan's new financial martial law regime, as it's called?
We can say this. Under our financial advisors, that we've had are the czars, the takeover czars of the schools. They have accumulated among them larger and larger and larger debts. They haven't solved a single financial problem for the Detroit Public Schools. In fact, they've exacerbated all of those problems. Last year, we went to trial to make clear that the financial manager that we had then, Rob Bob, who had sole authority over the finances of the district, was somebody that could not be trusted with making academic decisions for the students of Detroit. And through the course of that trial, we had evidence that was sent to us, and we were able to present of meetings that Rob Bob was in behind the back of the people of Detroit with charter companies, with development agencies, talking about how to administrate school closures in order to facilitate the development of charters and private schools and to change the compositions of the neighborhoods. And we won that court case. The judge agreed with us that the financial czar, Rob Bob, could not be trusted with overseeing the academics of the young people of Detroit, because we had expert witness after expert witness talk about how much our public school education was being degraded. And as soon as we won that case, the Michigan legislature changed the emergency financial manager law to give emergency financial managers that have jurisdiction over the schools with the exclusive right to determine academics as well as financial policies. So we've seen under our financial receiverships both an increase in the debt that is being incurred for public education and a decline in the quality of the education. It's a double whammy.
What does BAM, by any means necessary, plan to do in terms of resisting these school policies and the general shrinkage of Detroit?
You know, we're going to keep fighting. We did an occupation of a school called Katherine Ferguson, which is a unique school. It's the only school like it in the country that offers teen mothers an opportunity to complete their high school education and get a diploma and go to a school that includes their children in it. Just a great, great school. And we think that if we have to occupy Katherine Ferguson permanently, we will do that. The students and their children are prepared to do that, to keep that a public school, and we're hoping that kind of a movement can spread throughout Detroit, a movement of school occupations and just holding on to these schools, because we'll be damned if we give up public education in the city of Detroit or any other city in America. It's just one of the great gains of the civil rights movement, and to have it taken back and the new Jim Crow imposed on us, we're not going to let that happen.
That was Shanta Driver of BAM, By Any Means Necessary. Ralph Nader won't be running for president himself in 2012, but he has some ideas on how to mount a challenge to President Obama from the left. Obama's money men plan to raise $1 billion for his reelection. We asked Nader what a billion-dollar campaign means for the politics of 2012.
Well, what it means is a continuation of past elections where major subject areas, major constituencies are ignored, so that we won't see, obviously, a demand for a living wage. That would alienate the lobby known as the fast food industry, the Walmarts, the Kmarts, the fast food restaurants. They contribute money. And there won't be any talk about really cracking down on corporate crime. I think the first alleged corporate criminal convicted is just this week, and it was on insider trading instead of the real, more serious crimes, dealing with looting and draining trillions of dollars of worker pensions and savings, mutual funds, and unemploying 8 million workers and throwing more poverty onto the backs of the American people. So there's not going to be discussion there. Single-payer health insurance, forget it. It won't even be part of the discussion. Obama will be on the defensive, trying to defend his already heavily perforated Affordable Care Act, which for the most part doesn't go into effect in 2014, even though every year 45,000 Americans most of them poor, die because they can't afford health insurance to get diagnosed or treated. And those figures come from a Harvard Medical School research study, peer-reviewed in a December 2009 Journal of Public Health. That's 800 a week. Of course, there'll be no real discussion about the Afghanistan war and the continuing bloodshed in Iraq, or President Obama's declaration he'll go anywhere in the world, and regardless of national boundaries, international law, U.S. Constitution, and he's already shown that in Yemen, Libya, elsewhere, because he's taking away issues from the Republicans, and therefore all that will be left for the Republicans is to argue over their extremes, which they're doing now. And that's why I wrote an article recently where I predicted that unless there's some sort of events that we're not aware of, Obama's going to be elected in a shoo-in.
The entire political debate is dominated by talk of austerity, but Obama himself opened the door to that kind of conversation. Can he shut it, or does he want to?
You know, I think what he revels in doing is in letting the Republicans set the arena of debate, and then he takes a lot of it away from them. It's a rather interesting tactic. Instead of talking about poverty and getting rid of poverty, as Western Europeans have gotten rid of poverty in their countries, certainly poverty as we know it, by pushing for his campaign promise of 2008 for a $9.50 minimum wage, which is still $7.25 federal, instead of pushing for safety nets like universal health insurance, instead of cracking down on ripoffs, oil and insurance and banking and other ripoffs on consumers, which further impoverish them, particularly poor consumers, who the poor always pay more. But what he does is he rolls up his sleeves and he says, I'm going to tackle John Boehner, Speaker of the House, and the head of the Senate Republicans, Mitch McConnell, and I'm going to show them that I can out deficit reduction them and get more votes on the right side of the Democratic Party. I mean, it's really bizarre the way it's occurring. And he does that again and again. He's done it on military policy, foreign policy, done it on one area after another where the Republicans open up a arena of debate to try to put him on the defensive so he can lose votes. And he actually plunges in the arena and takes away their issues, and they're sort of left becoming more and more extreme. And they're going to be fighting out in the primary, probably 10 Republican candidates. And after a while, they're going to look pretty absurd because they're going to have to be more and more extreme, even the ones that don't want to be that extreme, in order to appeal to their narrow Republican primary base, starting in Iowa and then moving to New Hampshire.
But, of course, the net effect is to move the discussion further and further to the right.
Yeah, to the corporate. Yeah, to the corporate side. And that doesn't bother Obama at all, because he knows he has the liberal progressive voters in his pocket, and they're going nowhere, and they don't signal they're going anywhere. And the liberal intelligentsia, the people who you hear and on radio and listen to, watch on TV or read in papers, magazines, books, very, very few of them are predicting any kind of rebellion, even in the Democratic primaries. Right now, he has no opponent in the Democratic primaries. And a number of us are trying to appeal to maybe 70, 80 well-known Democrats, at least well-known in their areas of civil rights, poverty, environment, consumer protection, foreign, military policy, labor, to have a slate of candidates where they basically say, we're registered Democrats, we're going to run into primaries because, Mr. Obama, we want to provide you with a robust opportunity for debate, progressive issues that go to the soul of the Democratic Party, if not to the pocket of the Democratic Party. And we're going to meet you in Iowa and New Hampshire and all over the country. And we're not under any illusion we're going to defeat you. After all, it's a slate representing one sector of our political economy after another. But we're going to pressure you to confront the subjects, the victims of repression and exploitation and class warfare downward by the rich and powerful. You're not going to be able to avoid these because we're going to be there. And because we're a slate, you're not going to be able to say you're not going to debate us as you could if you're just, you know, one person challenging Obama. What do you think of that idea?
Well, how is that slate shaping up?
Yeah, it's shaping up to be a very dull Democratic primary where it'll be the same five-minute speech. And the press will cover him because he's president, obviously, no matter where he goes. And the risk he's taking by not having a robust primary is it will be an unexciting primary season, which is, you know, the bulk of the time until Labor Day, and people will stay home, and the young won't be excited, and they'll stay home, as they did in 2010. Obama paid the price for that. So if he was smart, he would welcome being challenged in the primary on substantive issues to excite his base. Thinks he can take away enough major issues from the Republicans so he can more than make up the votes he loses from people who stay home.
Well, that Democratic base has not been served. There's been little even pretense of serving that base. You predict then that the base will not be enthusiastic about turning out for this president?
No, it'll keep the vote count down. But let's face it, they have nowhere to go. They're not going to vote Republican. There's no real third party they're going to vote for. They're into a winner-take-all situation, and they want to be with winners. So even if they agree with the majoritarian agenda of third parties, like the Green Party was earlier, they won't vote for the candidate because they know that the system is rigged in favor of both major party candidates, exclusion from the debates by the two major parties who control the debate commission, as example, ballot access obstacles. And, of course, the winner-take-all, unlike in Europe where you have proportional representation. And if you get over 5% of the vote, let's say in a country like Germany, you get over 5% of the parliament. Here you get 49% of the vote, you end up with nothing. You know, basically, he looks at tens of millions of his voters and says, I don't have to cater to you because you and I know one thing. You got nowhere to go. And as long as those millions of people do not make demands on Obama and keep some doubt as to whether they're going to turn out for him, they are not going to get a hearing. They're not going to have any bargaining power, and they should make their vote dear to get. Whatever they do in the privacy of the voting booth, that's their business, of course. But why give up in April, May, June? Why signal that you got nowhere to go? Because if you got nowhere to go, they got nothing to give you.
There was a lot of talk, at least on the left, about the possibility of plumbing into the reservoirs of anti-war sentiment on the right. Ron Paul is again speaking his anti-war language and even opposing the execution of bin Laden. Do you think that there are these reservoirs of anti-war feeling on the right?
Yes. In fact, I wrote an article on military and foreign policy, the libertarian right, and some genuine conservatives, not corporatists who camouflage as conservatives, have a lot in common with liberals and progressives. They're against the Patriot Act's outrages. They are against the Iraq and Afghan war. They want to cut the military budget. They want the Constitution to be in effect when it comes to only Congress has the authority to declare war. And they're pretty good against corporate welfare and bailouts. That's pretty good for starters. But that may work in Congress, you know, to form certain coalitions. You got Ron Paul and Barney Frank with a task force to cut some of the lard and corruption from the military contracts budget. So that's already operating. But I don't think it's going to work in the 2012 election in the sense that they're not going to get together to form a new party or an independent candidate.
Consumer activist Ralph Nader. Republicans in Congress have a plan to get rid of Medicaid as we know it by turning it into a block grant program for the states. Katie Robbins, national organizer for Healthcare Now, says the GOP's Medicaid scheme would put millions of people at risk.
What that means is that the federal government would basically give a lump sum, a capitated amount, to states to spend on Medicaid. And this is different from how it's currently financed. If it moved to this lump sum approach, it means that states would be forced to either cut folks from the rolls of Medicaid or restrict the benefits that are currently offered. Medicaid is organized by states, so there's wide variety in how Medicaid is handled in every state, but the lump sum financing basically spells severe cuts, and that's going to impact people who are able to access care and what kind of care they're able to access on the program.
It would seem that Medicaid would get squeezed on both ends, less federal money, and then, of course, it would be administered by states, which are trying to cut wherever they can.
Exactly. The states are, like all of our local governments, are really in fiscal crisis, and there's really a dangerous debate going on right now. Instead of addressing some of the reasons why we have out of control health care costs or huge deficits, you know, folks in the U.S. Congress are unfortunately not looking at taxing rich people or really doing meaningful cuts to our military budget or, for example, looking at challenging the corporate control of our healthcare system, where hundreds of billions of dollars could be found in savings annually by challenging the role of the for-profit private insurance system in healthcare and the way it's organized in the United States. Rather than addressing these common sense solutions, they're looking at further squeezing the social insurance programs that provide the safety net for people in the United States. And it's really pretty meager when you compare it to other industrialized countries, but programs like Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security have lifted millions of people out of poverty. And by looking at these programs, it places the responsibility as if the responsibility for restoring our budgets in states and nationally is the responsibility of working people. And the reality is that we need to really challenge corporate power and tax the rich.
With Medicaid as a block grant program, wouldn't we expect that the gap between states that spend more presently on Medicaid and those that spend less would probably widen? That is, the gap between a New York and a Mississippi.
Yeah, absolutely. And even the folks in New York would expect to be cutting back. I mean, there's been a Medicaid redesign committee going on over the past year to look at where cost savings can be found. And so I think it's going to be across the board, but the gap will certainly widen. In Texas, for example, they were talking about eliminating Medicaid completely. And actually, that would result in spending much more money to care for people than it currently does. So it's just an insane proposal. However, there's also a fundamental problem at this moment because the passage of the national law last year, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, one of the major pillars of providing coverage to people, you know, the claim that 32 million people will be covered by this new law, is through an expansion of Medicaid. And so if we see leading up to the full implementation of this law, which is expected in 2014, that people being cut from the Medicaid rolls and benefits being cut from Medicaid right now really spells it's not looking good for using this program as a way to expand care to people in the future. So it's really concerning that we're seeing this fundamental breakdown in the structure of what the new law proposes to do around Medicaid. I mean, the people who are enrolled are going to be receiving less benefits, and then our tax dollars are going to be going to subsidize private insurance for folks, and yet we're not really challenging the private insurance model that wastes so much money on CEO salaries and advertising and anything but healthcare. So we still say that by moving to a Medicare for All system, we could save Medicaid, we could save Medicare, and we could provide health care as a human right to everyone in this country and actually save money. So we still see this as a fundamental call to action to continue building the movement to demand the right to health care for all.
President Obama, before he was President Obama, about 2 weeks before he was sworn into office, he actually put all of entitlements on the table. And it was him who appointed the Deficit Reduction Commission that recommended such draconian cuts across the board, including medical services. Did your organization expect that candidate Obama would lead the charge or give aid and comfort to those who would attack entitlements?
Well, I think the folks within the leadership of healthcare now were pretty cautious with all the candidates at the time. A lot of people worked very hard on the campaign for President Obama. But it was clear to us that even though he had previously been a supporter of single-payer healthcare, that specifically his language around reforming our healthcare system was shifting much more to the center. So we were not completely surprised. However, what we experienced was complete exclusion from the debate around healthcare healthcare reform. We actually organized civil disobedience actions in 2009 because single-payer advocates were being excluded from all of the discussions in Congress and the White House meetings around healthcare. So that was certainly something we weren't expecting. We were really hoping for a real, authentic, genuine debate on what it would mean to provide universal healthcare in this country, and we knew that single-payer healthcare as a Medicare for all system would be a major part of that debate, but unfortunately it was so dominated by corporate interests that we weren't able to break in a meaningful way. So now we're seeing progress on the state level, where, for example, Vermont has passed a law that's waiting to be signed by the governor that would essentially lays out a plan to move to a universal publicly funded system with a lot of the elements of single-payer financing included. So we're very energized by that, and we continue to see the movement building and calling for real reform to the healthcare system that meets the right to healthcare for people. So we're energized by that, but we were incredibly disappointed in the national debate, which didn't include a genuine discussion around universal care and single-payer healthcare.
Are patchwork state single-payer systems viable? Could they long survive as a patchwork, or do you see them as examples that the nation would follow in the future?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, but I know that the folks in Vermont are really working very hard to implement a system that's universal, sustainable, and publicly funded. So it really is it's a drastic what we see in other states and nationally. And because we believe in the sound policy that single-payer systems provide, that we believe that if it's implemented correctly, that it can work. And so we are optimistic that it can prove to be an example policy-wise, but also tremendous work has been done in the state to organize people. Really, this law was pushed into place by a people's movement through a groundswell of support around specifically a campaign that the Vermont Workers Center has run for about 3 years called The Healthcare is a Human Right. And they've really engaged thousands of people in this process. So I believe that as long as the people's movement is in place to keep pushing for the principles that they identified around the human right to health care, that they'll be successful. And I think it provides a real model for people all over the country. You know, if we want to see this happen other places, we have to get out and talk to our neighbors. We have to start organizing.
Katie Robbins of Healthcare Now. In America, what business wants, business usually gets, by hook or crook or threat. Dr. Richard Wolff is Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Massachusetts. Wolf recently wrote an article titled The Threats of Business and the Business of Threats, in which he describes bullying by big business and how to counter it.
We're paying record high prices at the gas pump, as you know, and yet the oil companies are making fortunes of profits, and yet we continue to provide them with subsidies, billions of dollars a year of taxpayer money as subsidies to companies that are making record profits. It's crazy. We give them tax loopholes that mean they pay lower taxes than most individuals and businesses. And finally, we basically do nothing to hold back $4 to $5 a gallon of gas. When the government, the federal government in this case, says to them, gee, we'd like to cut your subsidies, or gee, we'd like to close the tax loopholes, or gee, we'd like you to bring the price down, the answer of these corporations is always the same. Oh, no, you mustn't do that. And if you do it, look, we hate to tell you this, but we will have to close down operations here in the United States and move them elsewhere, or just shut down businesses here and there. And you know what that's going to do? That's going to mean unemployment and reduced tax revenues for the government. To put it in simple English, they threaten us. If you take away anything that we like and want and need, we will make it bad for you. We will hurt you. We will fire people and cut back our programs and so on. And all I'm saying is when that happens, and it happens all the time, every day, the government of the United States, since it's supposed to represent the whole of us, should be taking counteraction. I get very disgusted when I watch or read a politician's justification that nothing can be done about these problems. And as a footnote, I might mention that the subsidies for oil companies are 100 years old in the United States and have resisted countless efforts to try to get rid of them since they are obviously absurd and inappropriate. And the politicians keep justifying this by, oh, well, we can't do that because if we were to do it, then the companies will do all these other things that are so bad to us. basically what that does is it knuckles under to a threat. It's like caving in, it's being intimidated, and I don't see any need for that. The government has already all the legal tools at its disposal to say to these companies, if you threaten us when we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, then we're going to retaliate as well. And if you like, I can give you some examples of what those retaliations are that the government has it within its power to do and that would very quickly stop these corporations from the threats and from refusing to do what a democratic government ought to be making them do anyway.
Please do. List the countermeasures.
Okay, here's some of them. Number one, try to picture this in your mind. President Obama, or for that matter, any president, going on the public television and saying the United States government has, and I'll just use it as an example, had the following interactions with the ExxonMobil Corporation. We asked them to end the subsidies, we asked them to stop utilizing tax loopholes, and we asked them to bring down the price of petroleum to some degree, and we worked all this out, and this is what we asked them to do, and they have threatened us that if we push these measures through, that they will leave the country in ways, or they'll cut production, they'll lower taxes, they'll lay off people. This constitutes a threat against this country and against the mass of the people that this government represents. And so henceforth, and here comes measure number one, the United States government will buy its oil and gas from companies other than ExxonMobil, to utilize what all marketplaces provide you, which is if you're not pleased with the service or behavior or performance of one seller, you go to another. The United States buys huge amounts of oil and gas from all of these companies, and this would be a very powerful way of signaling displeasure. Step number two, the president, again Obama or anyone else, could travel the country and tell the people what just happened and why it happened, and then let the American people, each individual one, decide in his or her own mind whether they want to continue patronizing ExxonMobil as opposed to another company that didn't behave this way. And thirdly, just to keep it going, the United States, if it was confronted, for example, by all the oil companies getting together, which they often do, to act in unison, then the government can say, okay, if you're all going to be involved in threatening the United States, we will respond by setting up, the government has the money to do that, its own oil company. We can go around the world buying oil, we can refine it, it'll take a little while, but we will end up being a very powerful competitor to all of you, and we will be loyal to the country which provides us with the basis for operations. I can assure you that if corporations were confronted by a government that is as big, as sizable, and as powerful as this one, with anything like any combination, just of the three measures I mentioned, and there are more, but just playing with those three, you would get a much more compliant corporate response than we get now. We are not at the beck and call of corporations threatening us. We do not have to knuckle under. We do not have to collapse. What we do need is politicians who don't use the argument that these corporations are threatening to hurt us as a justification for doing what they want. What we need are politicians who respond if and when corporations threaten by using the power of the United States to counteract that threat. And I think we'd all be better off, although I admit that the corporations would be a little bit worse off. But we've had the reverse for so long now, we could do with a little bit of the other.
The corporations would consider that what you call a threat is just their exercise of freedom of speech, and that the massive contributions they make to political candidates are also freedom of speech.
Yes, they have always argued that, and I don't take that away. My proposal is not to take them away. They are free, which they have clearly exercised, to make the decisions they want to make and to threaten the United States government with retaliatory decisions in the event that we don't subsidize them or close tax loopholes and so forth. All I'm saying is two can play at that game. The government does not need and ought not to knuckle under those kinds of threats, and the government could counteract them by pointing out to these corporations precisely what it as a government is free to do. It does not have to buy oil and gas from company A. It can buy it from company B. It does not have to allow oil, a vital national resource, to be controlled by private companies that threaten the government. It could declare that to be a natural, a national resource, and that the government in itself should take over, just the way the government takes over the military, doesn't allow private armies. It wouldn't have to allow a private enterprise when and if one or more of them threaten the United States. And I think there would be massive, overwhelming majority support in the United States for a government that acted in that way.
Certainly on the popular level, big oil is probably less popular than it's ever been before, and it's never been popular. Are agencies, ratings agencies like Standard and Poor's, making these same kinds of threats when they speak of lowering the ratings on U.S. government bonds, unless the government conducts a fiscal policy to their liking?
Yeah, I think the same thing there is done. I think it's been common, for example, in the United States, for all kinds of companies, no matter what they're doing, to go particularly to local levels of government. My examples so far have been at the federal level, but you could do the same at the state or even at the town and city level when a company that has even as little as 200, 300, 400 employees goes to the local mayor and basically threatens, or if I wanted to use a harsher term, blackmails the local politician by saying, look, you're the mayor of this town. If we leave town and move our production a few miles down the road, we're going to lay off all of our people here. It'll be great news for the city on the other side of the state line. And you will be voted out of office by an angry community suffering economic hardship because we leave. Now, Mr. Mayor, what are you prepared to do for us so that we don't leave? That's the same kind of threat. They're basically going to the local politico and saying, we're threatening your political career, your political future. You got to give us a free parking lot, or you got to redesign the roads in some way we want, or you have to change the curriculum in your schools so that the children learn what we want them to learn. Whatever it is, this is normal business practice. What isn't normal, and what I wrote that article about, was to say that the governments, both at the local and federal levels, have a lot more power to represent our interests, that is the mass of the people, by counter-threatening, if you like, by saying, if you, the business, take this step, then we, the government, will take a counter-step. And the difference between them is, if we had politicians with the courage to do it, the mass of the people are on the side of a government striking back, not on the sides of the corporations. And that's a vulnerability on the business side that the government ought to be exploiting, because it can do the best for the most of us and stop this process in which we subsidize the companies that gouge us in the prices we have to pay.
But in fact, the politicians at the local and state and federal level pretend as if these are natural forces of weather over which they have no control.
Yes, and I'm not much surprised, and I don't think the American people are much surprised. If you allow wealth to be concentrated the way we do in the United States, in the hands of business in general and big business in particular, then of course they're not so stupid. They understand perfectly the argument I'm making. They understand clearly what the government could do on behalf of the mass of people in the face of what corporations are doing. And so they take the prudent step of making sure that the politicians who get to the top of the heap, the mayors, the governors, the presidents, the congresspersons, and all that, are in their pocket, are dependent on them for their campaigns, for their lobbyists, for their foundations, and all the rest of it, because it's not because they disagree with what I'm saying, it's because they understand precisely what I'm saying, that they need to control that, because if it ever got into the hands of the mass of people, then the government would be doing precisely the types of things that I was listing.
Corporation chiefs are all over the place lately, claiming that the United States has the highest tax rates in the developed world. Of course, they don't pay these taxes at these rates.
Yes, that's a perfect example of using your wealth to fill the airwaves and fill the mouths of pundits with a story that is not just slanted, it's just downright phony. Yes, it is correct that the official corporate profits tax rate of 35% in the United States for most companies above a very small size of business is relatively higher than in the rest of the world. But the minute you add the long list of tax loopholes, of exemptions, of all the special things that take up those hundreds of pages of the tax law, then it becomes quite easy to show, as many studies have done, that the actual rate paid, as opposed to the technical rate charged, is much in the lower, much in the neighborhood of around the low 20s, 21, 22%, and that is not at all higher than what's typical in many parts of the world. And indeed, many American corporations pay much lower than that. Even the New York Times, about 3 weeks ago, had a front-page article on the General Electric Corporation showing that it paid in the United States on its massive profits, one of the biggest companies in the world, something on the order of 3%. So it's way, way lower than the official rate. They have a staff, the New York Times story said, I believe of 700 or 800 lawyers and accountants who do nothing other than study the tax laws in all details to figure out every conceivable loophole, exemption, deduction that they can take, and that they've been doing that for years. And nobody steps in to stop them, and nobody says boo until there's a hoopla in the country and at least a few reporters look into it.
And yet GE has cut its workforce in the United States by one-fifth over the last 10 years, and their CEO was then chosen as a jobs advisor to President Obama.
Yes, it was extraordinary. Of all the people to pick, the only thing I found as mind-numbing as choosing Jeffrey Immelt of General Electric was making that hero of America, whatever the name of the title is, Medal of Freedom, Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is a billionaire in this country, one of the richest people on the earth, and one of the companies he owns is Moody's Investor Services. It's a subsidiary of the Berkshire Hathaway empire that he sits on top of. And Moody's was one of the three major companies that provided AAA ratings to all those toxic investments whose collapse was part of what set this whole crisis into motion. It's extraordinary to pick the head of GE that doesn't pay its taxes and Warren Buffett that is clearly responsible for a significant part of this crisis as the best people you could find in the United States to honor in the White House.
Professor Richard Wolff, famed Environmental Protection Agency whistleblower Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo says the EPA is racked with racism, despite the fact that the agency is run by a black woman, Lisa Jackson. Dr. Adebayo's struggle at the EPA led to passage of the landmark No Fear Act, which is supposed to protect whistleblowers. Since then, the man who fired Adebayo, Rafael De Leon, has been put in charge of civil rights for the agency.
It's not that he just fired me. That's sort of the least of the issues, I think. I think most whistleblowers assume that if you take on the institution, that at this point in our history, one of the almost certainties that you can expect is that the agency is going to kick back. That's a part of the responsibility that we take on as whistleblowers, I think, is that we are sacrificing and we are trying to make a difference in an important way. But this is a person, I think the 21st century has seen a mutation of the way racism is carried out in this country. In the 1940s and 50s and 60s, you had, you know, basically white managers, white sheriffs carrying out the will and the dictates of the people in power. After 1964, the system somehow mutated, and now you have in ever-increasing numbers Africans and African-Americans and Hispanics now basically being the conduits through which the ruling class and people in power carry out their dictates. And so I think you have to see De Leon in that historical context, and not just as an individual. He gains his power, the source of his power, is through carrying out these kinds of very vicious attacks against people of color, because it's much more difficult in court to prove racism if the person who is managing you is black or Hispanic. And so it's a natural movement from people in power to now assign this duty, this overseer role, if you will, to black managers within the federal government. So De Leon, I place him within that historic context. I'm not the only person. I think most black people and a lot of Hispanics have encountered their De Leons where they work, whether it's the private sector or the public sector. And so he's within the historical framework of an overseer.
And in De Leon's mouth, the words Rosa Parks, when he applies them to you, come out more like an insult than a praise.
Well, absolutely. And what's interesting about that is that that was not the first time someone had used, had slandered the name of Mother Rosa Parks in relationship to someone who's an activist. Because in the minds of a lot of still white people, reactionary black people, she's still a woman who did not know her place, a woman who made a decision that she was going to fight instead of give in to the power structure. And that is sort of the way they used her name, as a black woman in particular, who didn't know her place, who couldn't maintain her silence. And so the first time that was used was right before I went to trial, where it was in Chicago, and with a white guy who basically said, you know, we've got this Rosa Parks of EPA who's causing all this trouble at the agency, and she's just making everybody's life difficult. And one of the reasons why I won my case, by the way, was because that testimony was eventually heard right at the end of the case, and the jury was so horrified that people, particularly white individuals, were using the name of Rosa Parks in such a demeaning way that I really think it turned a corner in my case. Well, now you have a black Hispanic using the name of Rosa Parks in exactly the same way, allegedly using it in the very same way, as well as calling me and another woman who happens to be white pink elephants in the same conversation. This De Leon called a national meeting of EPA managers and just started slandering me and this other woman, as I understand it, calling us pink elephants. And you may recall what pink elephants mean. The total phrase is, she's a pink elephant who's more like a pit bull, but she doesn't wear lipstick. So that's the context he was using, pink elephant. And then he said, and you know, she thinks she's another Rosa Parks, in a very slanderous and demeaning way to Rosa Parks. We have asked EPA Administrator Jackson to query this individual as to whether he used these very racist and sexist terms towards two individuals, and she has refused to do that. There's no other way of looking at that except the EPA administrator has refused to take on the issue of racism and sexism at the EPA. And you have EPA employees writing and saying, you know, why do we want to work with people who demean women, who demean African Americans? Why should we be subjected to that kind of person in the workplace? And the EPA administrator has turned a deaf ear to all of those complaints and all those cries for help.
What does this say about measuring black progress by the number of black faces in high places?
It says that we have that racism has mutated it, that we have a 21st century equivalent to overseers. And so right now what we're doing is a letter writing campaign, and I would ask your listeners to please call the White House, call your member of Congress, and tell the member of Congress that we need accountability at EPA. We need the director of the Office of Civil Rights fired at the EPA. And we want this firing to be done immediately, because we don't think U.S. taxpayers should pay for people, particularly people who are in charge of enforcing civil rights laws, carrying out a form of virulent racism and sexism and using U.S. tax dollars to do it.
What does this say about this agency? Here, the No Fear Act is born in the bowels of the EPA, growing out of your case.
Right.
And yet it seems to get no respect within the EPA.
Exactly. I mean, and not only that, I'd even take it a step further. The man who fired me was actually placed in charge of No Fear Training by Lisa Jackson. And so she was sending a very clear message about what she thinks of people's struggle. And remember, the No Fear Act was not something that I did. It was thousands of federal employees who risked their jobs and their careers and the livelihood of their families to step forward and testify and march and cry and write in order for us to get a civil rights law passed. I mean, even though the news media has not covered it the way it should have been covered, this was a major civil rights battle. It was a battle. And we forced, you know, a reactionary president to sign this bill. I mean, that's fairly impressive, I think. But one of the things that we understand, whether it's the 1964 Civil Rights Act, whether it's the No Fear Act, whether it's the Americans with Disabilities, unless we continue the struggle with the same intensity that it took to get the law passed, all of these gains will be rolled back.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Joe Kempf.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.